Okay?
Well, the title of this is way too long. It's Dream Chasers in the Shadowlands, Exploring and Explaining Life's Possibilities in Literature, Art, and Music. You might think I've bitten off more than I could chew with a title like that. I know I do. If I had real sense, I would have cut off the "and explaining" part of it. I'm no more qualified to explain life's possibilities than anybody else, but plenty of people have tried to explain all sorts of things about life. So I suppose it's okay to be in a crowd of folks who recognize my limitations. We all question the meaning of life on different levels in a variety of situations. If we didn't question, we wouldn't be human. Because we live in what C.S. Lewis called the Shadowlands, we're forever exploring what lies beyond our grasp. We dream dreams, we chase rabbits down holes, we run toward the ends of rainbows, we search out the possibilities that life offers. Scripture calls this a hunger for God. And in His common grace, God provides us with opportunities to know all that we want to know and to seek all that we want to seek. When we touch upon a bit of glitter, whether it's diamond or glass, we cry with Archimedes, "Eureka!" to a world that seeks to discover that wonder that is grasped beyond the shadows. We know it's there, and we yearn for it. Viktor Frankl pondered man's search for meaning and in part concluded that it's the goodness and the kindness that we can provide to others that enables us to live lives that are meaningful. He said that it was that kind of action that kept some people from losing their minds in Auschwitz. When we read about such generosity, we're moved by it, we're awed by it, we're humbled by the awareness that there are many people who are so much better than we are ourselves. We wonder how they can be so when they're faced with hardships and dangers and life-threatening situations. When they're in relationships that are damaging to themselves in so many ways. We look around at a world so full of real evil, and we see people who seem to be able to rise above the evil and pour themselves out as offerings to others. What makes them do this? For Christians, this can be incredibly intimidating because we see people who don't profess faith in Christ, who are kinder, gentler, more generous, and more noble than we know ourselves to be. And in the worlds of fine arts, we're often enraptured by the performances of musicians, dancers, artists, and writers who seem to sense something beyond the comprehension of the rest of mankind. Even for those who don't profess belief in a creator God, they seem to touch His very mind. Why can't I be so good? My own world is full of cluttered hiding places of desire, a desire for ultimate meaning and fulfillment and joy. I don't think I'm unique in this. Perhaps we all have such hiding places. I suggest that we apply some practical feng shui that can enable us to live meaningfully in a world that is so full of God's glory that the very rocks cry out to Him, but is still a mere shadowland in which we chase our dreams. We share the planet with people of varied religious and philosophical beliefs. One thing we all have in common is a hunger for knowledge. As soon as we take our first breath in life, we start investigating. We want to know where we are, how things work, and what we can do. Think about how excited a child gets when he can first walk or learns to tie his shoes or ride a bicycle. "Look at me," he shouts. And we encourage him to reach even farther beyond himself to do even more. We push toward perfection. Our natural curiosity makes us want to organize and fix things and become specialists and even experts. There's an extraordinary urge in most people to be number one in some area, no matter how small that area may be. Well, some folks are really good at particular things, and then we call them experts. And there's the rub, because as soon as someone is better than someone else, jealousy pops its head up. And someone, somewhere, engages in a struggle for superiority over someone else. Desire always causes conflict. But desire is also what enables us to develop problem-solving skills, to create symphonies that make us cry for joy, to paint such masterpieces that generations stand in awe, to write stories and plays and poetry, to choreograph dance and play musical instruments and sing songs, all in ways that enable our listeners and viewers to experience that desire with us. When Chicago's World Fair was held in 1893, visitors wept for joy at the wonders they beheld in that great white city. The feats of architecture and showmanship were unique to the time. Later, Edison's telegraph claimed the workmanship of God. Still later, Armstrong's walk on the moon held the world in breathless awe at man's desire fulfilled to cut the bonds that held him to the earth. Augustine's famous one-liner, "Our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee," directs us toward an awesome knowledge of our Creator rather than his creation. But life's real temptation is to be the Creator himself, to play God. Robert Louis Stevenson said, "The world is so full of a number of things, I'm sure we should all be as happy as kings." That's a loaded statement, but I think it comes down to a desire to worship the creation and reject the Creator, to judge creation from a human perspective. In the world we live in, the rejection is seen more as a blessing than a curse. I'd like to explore the blessings we receive when we employ those restless urges to create. Our intellectual abilities, both our reason and our intuition, enable us to do just that. The great art, music, and literature that we all enjoy seeing, hearing, and reading are the result of our hunger toward perfection, our struggle to be what we are not. And those works are certainly glorious to behold. They demonstrate what Lewis called our heart's desire, that constant struggle and striving toward perfection that's just out of reach, just beyond the shadowlands, what we can count on not being what we imagine it to be right now, but what it will be down the road. Thus, we hunger to investigate the unknown and create in our minds and in more solid form expressions of those ideas that are so important to us. And we call this art. Art enables us to express our hunger for that which is beyond our natural perception. Art is emotional, disturbing, and invigorating. Art offers us opportunities to explore ideas both internally and externally, to seek to understand the inexplicable, and sometimes to share those ideas with others. Storytellers are word artists. Good stories work out what we most hunger to see, but don't. They enable the author to create, to play God, using plot, setting, characters, the movement of action, toward a complete whole. Aristotle defines tragedy as an action that is serious, complete, and of a certain magnitude, in which incidents arouse pity and fear in the audience. And we can define comedy, of course, as complete and of a certain magnitude as well, and its particular incidents arouse other feelings in the audience. Well, these parameters are the basis for the tragic and comic literature that we're most familiar with. Good word artists establish imaginary worlds. Wendell Berry's agrarian world of Port Arthur, Marilyn Robinson's Gilead, C.S. Lewis's Narnia, Tolkien's Middle Earth, Anthony Trollope's Village of Barchester. Those are some of my favorites. Shakespeare created King Lear's world and Lady Macbeth's nightmares and Henry V's Band of Brothers. Their creative imaginations produce illusions that become almost concrete realities to themselves and to their readers. So much so that authors and readers talk about the characters and their settings with as much familiarity as we do our own families and households. Last week I heard Nobel Prize recipient Seamus Heaney describe his poetry as expressive of himself through characters created to open his mental worlds to his readers. When presented with a prize some years back, he was called a poet of the earth, whose poetry, like the soil, is something to be plowed and turned over. I admit that the literature I most value is connected to the earth, perhaps because it was out of the dust of the ground that God created man, that the writers I find closest to God's glory look so closely at his creation. They glimpse the glory beyond the shadows of this world. Perhaps Plato's shadows and ideals in his allegory of the cave hit close to this mind. Or from another perspective, we see in part in this life, but one day we'll be face to face. To live as Christ, but to die as gain. Art uses the physical, the here and now, and the day-to-day to give us glimpses of what lies beyond our natural perceptions. G.K. Chesterton has suggested that this world is the divine debris of a vision. Maybe the good creation that fell is that debris. Well, if so, art seeks to imitate and reconstruct it. Sculptors remark that they examine a block of wood or stone in order to find the essence of the object crying to come out. Some have even claimed that, like a makeup artist who can bring out the beauty of a person's face, so can their hands and tools bring out the real beauty of a natural element. Or as coal under pressure becomes a diamond, so a block of marble under the hand of Michelangelo becomes the Pietà. It is an act of God, or of man, employing the creative powers granted by God's grace in the Shadowlands. Painters can copy what they see before them, but almost all, from Rembrandt to Monet to Jackson Pollock, claim to explore the inner being of the object they paint. They see more of the surface as they study its form. They bring to light that which connects them more intimately with the form. How does light play against shadow? How are colors and shapes and values distinguished by the creator? Some people say they feel inspired to paint or draw or sculpt. I think it's reasonable to call it that. Consider Lewis's description of the creation of Narnia when it began. Aslan sang the world into being, and the forms that were created reflected the tones of his song. This really is similar to the experience of Kandinsky, an abstract painter of the last century, who tells of attending a concert with his family when he was a child. He was bored by the music until he put his head back and closed his eyes. Suddenly, the music took on form and color, and he was anxious to go home and paint the music that danced in his head. Viewers of art may sense something like this when they look at a work of art, a sense of awe felt when examining the form and the details. Circling a sculpture or sensing the multiple perspectives of a painting can help the viewer get a sense of that glory the artist tried to express. Christians are supposed to be in the world but not of it. You may have heard people say, "I know what I like," when they reject the value of some art or music or literature that doesn't appeal to them. I think it's more important to examine art in enough intimate detail to get to know the mind of the maker behind the art. By knowing more about particular works, we come to enjoy and appreciate those works. Dorothy Sayers advocated this, as well as argued that we must be taught to think. That is more likely to happen when we come to like what we had come to know intimately. Like painting and sculpture, music also demonstrates a hunger for God. As a musician becomes more intimately connected to both the instrument and a composer's work, he experiences more of the wonder of creation. We've all taken music lessons at some time, and we remember the good, the bad, and the ugly, all the good and the bad and the ugly sides of those lessons and the resultant recitals that we had to participate in. But some people are real musicians. I've seen performers like cellist Yo-Yo Ma cry during the execution of a piece, not because he wanted to get off the stage, but because he was so caught up in the music that he could realize more of his heart's desire in tears, which brought the audience to tears. Beginners have trouble just getting through a piece of music. Musicians are able to get the music through to themselves and to their listeners. When the music gets through to you, the rational elements combine with the intuitive elements into something else entirely, a creation outside and beyond either reason or emotion. Consider too the character of Galadriel in Tolkien's Middle-earth. When the end of the age was coming and the elves knew they'd be leaving the world, Galadriel told the hobbits, "I must diminish in order that the glory of the new world be made evident." So it is in a musical performance. The performer recognizes that he or she is the vehicle for the interpretation of the music. Without the score, the instruments, the other musicians, and the audience, the performance can't take place. The performer seeks to interpret the mind of the creator, and each performer may very well have a different interpretation, as every painter sees a landscape or a face differently, or every writer sees different opportunities for characters in the settings they create. These interpretations cause both the creator and the interpreter to hunger for that ideal Plato said is only now reflected on the cave's back wall. At the close of Tolkien's trilogy, when the new age of Middle-earth is before him, Sam just breaks down and cries at the glory, a glory he could never put his finger on, a glory so glorious it is beyond his ability to describe. And that, I believe, is what we most hunger to express in art. Some of what is expressed makes us cry, but it's nothing compared to what is in store for us beyond the Shadowlands. Lewis provides readers with another environment to consider mankind's desire to create within the Shadowlands in his novel, The Great Divorce. An artist is visiting the borderlands of heaven and is invited to partake of the joys to be found in the presence of God. He's awed by what he sees, and he says, "I should like to paint this." When he's told not to bother, he's disappointed that he can't find artistic expression by copying what he sees before him. He's told, "When you painted on earth, it was because you caught glimpses of heaven in the earthly landscape. The success of your painting was that it enabled others to see the glimpses too." When he asks to see famous people like Monet and Cézanne, he's informed that if they're there, they don't need to bother with all that was so important to them in life. He can't accept this. He just can't take it in. After all, wasn't their art what they lived for? The heavenly being who's his guide was once a painter himself, and he tells him ink and catgut and paint were necessary down there, but they're also dangerous stimulants. Every poet and musician and artist, but for grace, is drawn from love of the thing he tells to love of the telling, till down in deep hell they cannot be interested in God at all, but only in what they say about him. Their own reputations are more important to them than the one who created them and gave them opportunities to know him. Well, academics are certainly not immune from this love of the telling. Lewis knows the academic mind and its susceptibility to self-glorification all too well. Those visitors who reject heaven for hell return to its depths to form reading and discussion groups and attend conferences where they can present papers. Lewis tells us that in the eternity that stretches before us, everyone gets exactly what he wants. For those engaged in academic work who desire to escape the Shadowlands for the glory that is yet to be, an eternity of research papers and academic conferences is hell indeed. 2 years ago, at a conference, I met James Elkins, an academic, with what appears to me a clear understanding of Lewis's argument against that artistic prerogative to create for the sake of self-glorification. Elkins teaches art history at the University of Chicago and is involved in the Art Institute. He's edited a series of art criticisms And a recent work, Reenchantment, explores how art enables us to imagine and interpret our world in supernatural and metaphysical ways. Elkins suggests that art reflects what refuses to die when social restrictions are imposed upon it. Disenchantment happens when critical parameters and theoretical approaches break that spell of awe and wonder we experience outside the parameters. Disenchantment limits our imagination to reason. However, constructive and valuable criticism occurs when enchantment and disenchantment effectively engage. Depending on the critic's purpose, the meaning that may be given may be used to destroy or alter or develop our consciousness about that which so perplexes us. Criticism can either enable or disable according to its purpose. When we ask why or how about almost anything, we're engaging in disenchantment with the object. The scientific method attempts to understand God's creation through reason. Being both enchanted with the unknown and trying to critically understand and interpret the unknown can allow us to make greater sense and ascribe meaning to the unknown. We can break it apart, and by understanding its parts, attempt to interpret the whole. And depending on our purpose, we either enable or disable reenchantment to take place. I believe that God sent his Son into the world of shadows, a world filled with the clamor of people seeking to discover a treasure that would make them happy. Some people call this a seeking for enlightenment. Some people call it a seeking after truth. For some, like Viktor Frankl, it is the search for life's ultimate meaning. Jesus entered a world of sin, a world filled with hate and wrongdoing and injustice. Many of his followers believed he had come to make the bad man go away and restore Israel to its former days of Davidic glory. This is the world where he learned to play with the other boys, where his father taught him carpentry skills and his mother baked bread for him, where he had a unique bar mitzvah, where he drew children to his lap and laughed with them, where he ate with his friends, went to weddings and funerals, went fishing, and sang psalms on the Sabbath. I'm awed by this, both the known and the unknown, of the life of a man who spent his life for me. And as we walk through the shadowlands of this world, we encounter those people and those instances that he interacted with as well. We have a conscious awareness of the metaphysics that allows us to see through a glass darkly, recognizing that what we now see is neither what is nor what will be. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And we are awed by the unknown that we will someday recognize. We seek not only the essence of meaning, but the whole of meaning. So in our own time, we can develop a wholesome attitude of welcome to those forms of literature, art, and music that we don't understand. They are shadows that we interpret various ways. And exploring those forms of art enable us to connect to the soul or the essence of the object, to step out of the context of the motivation for the artwork and step into its spirit. Songwriter Michael Card once said that the Christian is able to swing out into eternity in confidence that he is wrapped in the everlasting arms of his Savior. He expressed for us what is glimpsed in the shadowlands of artistic attempts to connect to the essence of the object of desire. There's a famous old story that we love to hear. That story doesn't have the happy ending that a moral story would provide. It has all the attributes of Aristotle's Elements of Tragedy. Its tones are discordant and its images are neither pleasant nor beautiful. It ends in a grotesque and shameful death in which the protagonist's friends deny him, forsake him, and run into hiding. It is full of despair, And even when the afterward comes and the tomb is bare and the resurrection is realized, Jesus goes away with the promise to come again. But after 2,000 years, we're still waiting. His followers have joined him in the agonies of death, persecution, and earthly torment by their opponents. Bloody wars have been fought in his name, and his teachings have been warped and used to serve foul purposes. Hatred of him, of the Father who sent him, and of his followers has evolved over the centuries to a point that the world is poised to destroy every evidence of his outpoured love that has held the world in place until now. If we're waiting for a moral truth, we have a long wait. However, that bit of literary narrative describing the final days of Jesus' life was written not by famous Judaic scholars or Greek philosophers or academicians, but by simple friends and followers who discovered the possibilities of and the enchantment with a relationship with the Creator of all that was and is and ever shall be. Much of the music and art and literature of the world since then has been created in reaction to those days and that life of a man who came from heaven to earth. I think it's worth our notice that history itself turns on the events of one who most of the world wishes had stayed in the grave, but didn't. One day last summer, the high school Sunday school kids and I took the train to the Art Institute. We spent the morning there, and then we left to get some lunch, and then we walked over to Millennium Park on our way back to the Art Institute. We started walking up the hill, and all of a sudden, music from the Pittsburgh Pavilion flooded over us. The CSO was practicing. The music surrounded us and drew us up the hill and into the pavilion. We sat down, and we all just breathed. I don't remember what they were practicing, but they were intent on creating a work of art together, each instrument taking its part and joining in perfect symmetry with each other. It was midsummer, the conductor was wearing shorts, the performers were in shorts or jeans and t-shirts. What they wore didn't affect their performance. Their performance was almost of a separate dimension. And as we listened, we saw beyond the shadows of the pavilion and the stage and the other people in the audience. The sounds traveling through the air and enveloping us took us to another place beyond the world we know. The possibilities we value or anticipate in our particular place in life will someday dissolve into nothing, not even a memory. What we are and were will not matter because we'll stand before the face of God. We groan and yearn and desire in this life, and we find expression of those desires in what we do. We explore the possibilities of life, and we build lives that reflect those things we most value. And we see, read, and hear how others have explored their own values. Art, in all its forms, is an expression of those values. We share our art, and we touch each other with our art, because we are communal creatures. We hold to the memories of the past and the expressions others and we have made of their values. We chase our dreams in the shadowlands, and we hope above all things that those who have searched beyond the shadows and hungered after the possibilities will join us in that eternity of enchantment with what we will know is not shadows on a cave wall, or mere academic perspectives, but the glory of our glorious God that enables us to weep with joy. Because that old, old story, the one that hasn't ended yet, most certainly will.
Are you okay, maybe if there is any questions that some people might want, any questions that you want to yeah, thank you. That was really beautiful. I mean, that was almost prose. I really, really appreciate your work on that. And I'm sure you might have maybe copies of that if anyone wants to see it. But thank you. Yeah. Any questions you want to ask Nancy on this topic of the Shadowlands and art?
Think about it.
Yeah.
you sort of said it a little bit, so what version do you think as hard as you can about this, and you put in the work that was required
to get out of your book? Well, because Rick originally wanted me to talk about Chris Common, and I thought
he would come. Right? Who wants to get a ring?
Because that had to do with journeys. And so we discussed the fact that the story of Pierce Common begins with a dream on a hillside. And how so much of literature is about those dreams and imaginings that people have. And then I thought, it's not just literature, but it's art and music. And every person who has those desires to create, they do it in the form in which they're most expert. And I'm interested in all three, an expert in none, but an appreciator of them. And when I go to the Art Institute all the time, I'm listening to music all the time, I'm reading lots of literature, and most of what we have around us is created by people who don't profess a faith in a creator God. Well, maybe I shouldn't say most, but yeah, probably most. But yet, we're all influenced by the work of Christ and history, literature, art, music, all of that. And so it just got considering how I could put all of that together succinctly within the time span, which worked.
I don't know if you find this in your writing something, but when I'm doing my artwork, I don't always know where I'm headed when I start. I just let my subconscious do the driving. And I find when my conscious mind gets out of the way and I let my subconscious do its thing, that's when I produce my best work.
I think people, I said that we want to be God. That's what the temptation was in the garden. You know, the knowledge of good and evil. You want to be God. And so when we do these things, it is both a blessing and a curse. And when we do our best work, it's magic. It's electric. And a couple of Sundays ago, Rick mentioned Jesus is hurrying to heal the person, and the woman comes up behind him. And it wasn't in Matthew, but in one of the other Gospels, he felt power go out of him. Like, you can almost feel that. You can almost feel that when it's working, when you're playing a piece of music and it is doing, if it's making you cry and you're experiencing that. Or if you're looking at a piece of art or hearing some music or reading a phrase that is so close to something beyond you that you can't quite reach. But
yeah, I know. It was even part of the painting. I look at that and I'll think, wow, where did that come from?
And it's nothing. It's so nothing. Because if you read The Great Divorce, you know, that's frightening. Because the best we can do in life is just nothing compared to the Creator. Well, you know, we consider ourselves creators. Oh, this is my artwork. This is my story. You know, this is my little bit of music. And it's debris, like Chesterton. It's just the trash, the absolute trash that might as well be swept away for the glory of God.
But you didn't say it was trash. You said it was a poor reflection or something like that.
Well, Chesterton, the Chalice, yeah, but Chesterton said that what we seem to see around us is a divine debris, and that makes me think of refuse. And to us, it's marvelous. It's the best that mankind can be. But the best that we can be isn't anywhere close to what we will be when we see God face to face. And so in The Great Divorce, these people who are making that little bus trip from hell so they can see, you know, the Edge of Heaven, they go back because they don't want them. They'd rather go back to the...
Do you think when a Christian creates music or art or literature, though, that does that not, in perhaps a non-believer, plant a seed, even if they're unaware of it?
That's the idea, yeah.
That would be the purpose of a Christian writer.
Yeah, but when unbelievers create great works of art, first time I saw Jackson Pollock, I thought, what? And now I'll look at his stuff and I'll stand there for 20 minutes and I'll buy it up and I'm making sense of it. But so there are all sorts of things that are created by people who don't profess faith. But they can still be...
But the common grace.
Yeah. Quakers say there's bad God in every man.
Are you suggesting that all our work is reflective of God?
No. I think it's certainly possible that one of the ways that we're made in God, God is a creator, yeah. And one of the ways that we're possibly made in God's image is to have this creative desire for ourselves. And it doesn't have to be in three disciplined image. I mean, it could be, landscape.
Yeah.
Or cooking or whatever.
When a woodworker or a carpenter. And, some people create things because they're angry, and they do things out of frustration and hatred and all of that, but that's still a creative act, and our God's a creative God, when we are making it, so we have that ability to create, but it can be used for good.
I wanted to say something. You said something so profound. You talked about the danger of not praising God with our art or anything like that, but in trying to praise ourselves or become our gods. And what does that have to lose for God given him this beautiful gift? I mean, he was a top angel. A lot of people say he was a praise angel. He was a giant of music. And yet, we forgot to worship God with it and began to worship ourselves. So I think that sometimes when people have this beautiful gift that was meant to glorify God, whether it's painting or art or even great literature, that there's that danger of not recognizing that God gave this to me to worship him.
Yeah, there's always that danger. People say, oh, that was so great. Like, was it George Whitfield? He comes down from preaching and this lady goes up and says, that was so amazing. You were just eloquent. And he goes, yeah, thank you. The devil tells me that.
So I like what you said. You said what refuses to die. There's that part of us that refuses to die when social and political restrictions are placed upon us. That's always the first thing, the Nazis came, the first thing. They try to take away from the Jewish people with their art, literature, their books.
Yeah, but when you're restricted by particular parameters, yeah, it limits you. But on the other hand, good theorists and good critics can use those parameters to better understand. And that's why I said, when you think of the scientists, well, they try to understand, they use reason, and they use particular parameters to make more sense of things. And isn't it wonderful that we have good medicine now because of scientists who use parameters to learn how to take care of this? Yeah. You don't have to shake beads over the head to help. Yeah, it works, but so it helps. That's kind of cool. Thank you, guys.
All right, well, thank you again, Nancy, and, yeah. And thanks for coming out tonight, and we'll keep you posted on what's on tap for the next Sunday night special. Thank you.
Thank you.